Welcome to the Madison County Milk House. I'm Samantha Field. I am the Public Information Officer for Madison County. And joining me is Matt Ertz, our county historian. Matt, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's always fun.
I keep getting, we really like listening to Matt. He tells us really interesting things. I didn't know that happened here in Madison County. So, you know, in tradition of me being last minute right now, this is the last day of Women's History Month, and we might as well get you on to talk a little bit about women's history here in Madison County.
Yeah, we have a very unique history across so many spectrums in this county, but we have a lot of women who were incredibly progressive and forward-thinking and were, you know, women that did things that others hadn't done before, and we wanted to touch base on some of those people, and there's lots of other women who did amazing things, but we just wanted to touch on a few of them today that you may not know lived here or what they did or the impact they had, not only in our county, but across New York and in some cases across the nation.
And I guess one of those women who did have an impact across the nation, let's start, I guess, you know, a little early history in the early 1800s, late 1700s. We had a woman who, you know, she's got some presidential connections.
Yeah. So late 18th, early 19th century, a gentleman by the name of Colonel Smith, William Smith, and his wife, Abigail, moved to what is today the town of Lebanon. Abigail was the daughter of President John Adams and the brother of President John Quincy Adams. She moved here for, it was a pretty brief period, just a few years. Colonel Smith received a land grant and set up here in Lebanon. He actually was our representative to the House briefly. But Abigail Adams, you might know, was a unique woman. She was very opinionated. She was very powerful. And she ended up moving away back to her home in Massachusetts. She had breast cancer and she died, unfortunately, in 1913. But she spent probably at least a few years, 4 or 5 years, living in Lebanon. And if you ever go down towards Earlville on the right side of the highway, I think it's Route 12B, mm-hmm. There's actually a marker that denotes where the steps of their home was. So you can actually see where they lived. So that's kind of a little neat piece of history that we had, you know, a direct tie to two presidents that was living in the county here.
And I think that's really interesting because sometimes I feel like we forget that New York State had such an integral role in the early development of our country. And, you know, I mean, if people are obsessed with the musical Hamilton and things like that, so you kind of understand that. But, you know, even here in rural Madison County, there were ties to the early onset of this country and the early politics of this country. It wasn't just, you know, Virginia. It was, a lot of it was New York State based.
Yeah, you know, it's very true. New York played an integral role in where we are. You know, Madison County isn't formed until 1806, but obviously in the very prehistory we have the Haudenosaunee people, the Oneida Nation. And then, you know, after that, as the country starts to develop, we're settled by a lot of American Revolution, veterans and they brought their families here, and that leads to our development in a lot of ways. And obviously, in many ways, we were kind of a transient county. We didn't have families stay a ton of time. A lot of them moved down west. But that also shows, as you look out across the country, we see a lot of people from Madison County that were governors in Michigan and Wisconsin and Montana. And, you know, the founder of Stanford University was from Madison County. So we see all these things that kind of come out of the early history of the United States have ties to Madison County.
This is why we like having you on. So let's jump a few years. I guess shortly after the death of Abigail Smith, a woman was born in Brookfield, and she would spend the good part of her life educating people of color in the 1800s. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, so Myrtilla Minor was born in Brookfield in 1815. She was a fairly sickly child, but she took education as a very important thing. Worked incredibly hard, took jobs to be able to go to school, and she ends up going to school in Clinton, New York, and later she goes to a school in Rochester. And in 1846, she takes a position at a place called the Newton Female Institute in Mississippi. And this was the first time in her life she saw slavery kind of firsthand. It impacted her greatly. She sought permission to teach African-American girls that were enslaved there to read, and she was denied. And she completed the semester and promptly left. She couldn't handle it. So she moves up and starts seeking help. And in 1851, she finances a school with help from Quakers like John Hopkins. And Harriet Beecher Stowe was actually someone who helped donate. And she opened a school called the Normal School for Colored Girls in Washington, D.C. And she was both the the teacher, the principal, and she was the defender. It was not a popular thing. She actually learned how to shoot a gun to help protect her school. It was forced to move a number of times throughout Washington, D.C. But it did become a thing, and her main goal was to teach young African-American women to read, and then her goal was that they would go into the South and help educate folks down there as well. She unfortunately passed away fairly young in 1864. As I said, she had some significant health issues. Her school continued on, and today that school is actually the University of the District of Columbia, who consider her like the matron of their school. And she spent a good part of her early life, you know, up until she completed her education, living in Madison County in rural Brookfield. She was inducted into the National Abolition Hall of Fame and Museum for her work. You know, and when you look at the idea of opening a school, not only in 1851, but, you know, that's 10 or 12 years before the Civil War, 11 years before the Civil War starts. So that's a really huge thing for a woman to do, and a really important aspect of our history.
And it's nice to know that we, you know, have ties to, I guess, movers and shakers, if you will, of the age. And there are women who do a lot for, you know, other women who can't, around the world, who cannot get education because of, you know, their culture and things like that. And this has been happening for hundreds of years, and, you know, it's nice to know that somebody who lived here really worked really hard for that.
Yeah, and it's important to highlight people like her to remind us that you can come from parts of the world that there's not a lot, but you can make an impact.
And I guess, you know, more women who made an impact. This is kind of more of a club thing, but, you know, people know the movie A League of Their Own. But here in Madison County, female baseball teams were way before World War II.
Yeah. So in 1868, the hamlet of Peterborough hosted what is believed to be one of the earliest baseball games that featured two teams completely of women. The Peterborough Women's Baseball Club had around 50 members. It was captained by a woman named Nanny Smith. And they played their first game July 25th, 1868. You can look it up. It was covered by newspapers across the country. There was two articles that kind of went hand in hand. One was very positive. One was somewhat stereotypically negative. But the women did play. There was like a varsity and a junior varsity team by today's standards. The varsity team thumped the junior varsity team. But it was a team of all women. It drew a pretty substantial crowd. There's a famous picture of it that you can find pretty easily if you Google it. And unfortunately, that picture was, we're not sure how accurate it is, but it gives you an idea of what it might have looked like. That picture, I believe, is in the Baseball Hall of Fame, amongst other places. But, you know, that idea of, again, an early athletic event featuring only women was really important to the era. And, that it happened in Madison County is a big deal.
And that kind of reminds me, like, last year we celebrated Title IX here in New York State, and, you know, the anniversary of that. Well, not the anniversary, but, you know, that, you know, we had women baseball teams as far as the 1860s. So, I mean, this is a good place for Title IX to be as well.
Yeah, it does make sense. Yeah.
So I like the next lady we want to talk about. So she is, we should talk about Zora Lucia Card.
Yes.
Did I say that wrong?
No, you're good.
Her life kind of reminds me of the book Water for Elephants, or, you know, the popular movie Water for Elephants. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, so Zora Lucia Card was born in Casanova. She grew up Casanova, Fenner, and those areas. She goes to Casanova Seminary, and she starts to work for a company called the Wilbur Opera House. And in 1902, she joins a circus, and she married the president, the superintendent guy by the name of Fred Alispaugh. And she starts working with animals, and her work, she starts working combining lions and tigers. She balanced herself on the tusks of elephants, and she moves to a different circus called the Sells Floto Traveling Circus, who hypes her up as the, quote, bravest woman in the world. And you can look up and find all sorts of photos of her sitting on elephant tusks, you know, in a cage with lions. And she was known for a long time as the bravest woman in the world. She retired fairly young, and she died fairly young in 1936. She lived in Florida at the time of her death. But, you know, she set this kind of thing that women could do all these things that men could do. Again, traditionally that role was reserved for men, and now you have a woman working in the cage with again, lions and tigers and elephants, these huge animals, and was this forefront and this really popular woman in the history of entertainment before we had television, before we had, you know, even radio to a certain degree. So it was a really big deal for her to be there and tell these tales and again, show the opportunities that were there for people that wanted to do something different.
And even as a celebrity, if you will, of the time, you know, she also, you know, circuses kind of get a little bit of a bad rap with when it comes to animals and things like that, but it seems like she actually cared a lot about the animals that she worked
with. She did. She was pretty famous for how she treated her animals, and after her retirement, an elephant that she worked with actually went crazy and killed a person, and that kind of forced her to go even further away from the celebrity life. But she was known for kind of caring for her animals, and that again, that's an important thing to point out, that, you know, this was a person who took what she did very seriously and make sure that she did everything she could to keep everybody happy and healthy.
Another thing New York State, you know, is really known for, and, you know, you and I have talked about, you know, the abolition movement in this area, but we also have strong ties to the women's suffrage movement, which all was happening kind of around the same time. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the women's suffrage movement really takes off in the late 19th century, and in 1894, every county in New York State hosted a suffrage association conference. And in Madison County, ours was in April of 1894 at the Monroe Opera House in in Oneida. And if you're familiar with Oneida, that's roughly where the police station is, the old Herb Phillipson's building would have been today, kind of at the intersection of Main and Madison Street. And there was two keynote speakers there. One was Susan B. Anthony, who I think most people know by name, and the other was a woman by the name of the Reverend Anna K. Shaw, who's a really interesting character in history, a very early minister, and she really struggled to get a position and eventually does get a position as a minister. The conference was incredibly well attended. What's interesting for our purposes is it's the first time we see a lot of women from, again, our more rural towns taking part and being active. And not only that, they actually appoint town councils. So they actually get people from each town to be on a countywide board. And then they're going back into their local communities and talking about the importance of women's suffrage. And this is also the start of our Woman Pro Suffrage Association, which launches right around then. We have the meeting minutes. The Madison County Historical Society houses the meeting minutes for that place, for that organization. And that runs right up until women's suffrage happens in 1918 in New York. And we're very fortunate, too, to have an anti-suffrage society's meeting minutes at the Casanova Public Library. And that tells the story of why there was women that didn't want the right to vote. So we have kind of the both sides of the story. And it is really great that we have this so that we can understand what both sides were thinking. You know, on the pro-suffrage side, women wanted that opportunity, especially if you were a working class woman. You're paying taxes, but you have no say in your taxes was a big argument. That idea of kind of from the American Revolution, no taxation without representation. And then on the anti-suffrage side, they had their arguments that were, you know, that we have a lot of posters that are today would be considered comical. But then the idea of rights that women have without the opportunity to vote, things that could happen, you know, if women got the right to vote. So you have this kind of yin and yang, and it allows us to understand better the mindset. And it all started off with this event in the city of Oneida that launched kind of our suffrage movement, you know, beyond kind of in a more organized way.
I think it's always interesting that you always talk about, you know, looking at both sides. You talk about that a lot when we look at a lot of history, you know, because, I mean, history is a snapshot. We only know what we see from what is written or photos. Well, photos now, drawings, paintings. And do you feel that, like, looking at both sides gives us a better picture of what was actually going on?
I think in everything we do, we should try to understand both sides. Because if we don't and we just take one side, it lends you to make the same mistakes of the past. Whereas if at least you listen to both sides, you have an understanding of what the argument is. You know, whether it's valid by today's standards is something that can always be debated. But it's always good. We always want to understand, you know, even in things like war? Why did one side think this and why did one side think that? What pushed them to that level is always a good thing to know. And in movements like this, in the abolition movement, we talk about having the 1852 conference in Casanova and talking about, you know, there was articles from local business owners then that were like, we don't want this here. You know, why didn't they want it? What was their fear? So that's the kind of things we try to look into, it just understand what people were thinking and where their mindset was coming from. And reasonable chance that they're flawed ideas, but why? What were they thinking? We always want to know that so that, again, we learn from our past and hopefully move forward in a better way.
And I feel like that's something we should keep in mind now for our present, if you will, because, you know, we may not always agree, but we should keep in mind what the other side is saying to understand where they may be coming from. You don't have to agree with them, but right.
It's always good to listen and have a conversation.
Yes. And you and I could just keep having conversations. We've done it. So I want to jump a little forward off of women's suffrage from the late 1800s, early 1900s, to now the early 2000s, if you will. We here in Madison County just elected our first woman Madison County court judge.
Yes.
Rhonda Youngs. And you were able to sit down with her about two and a half months into her her term here with the county. What'd she have to say?
Yeah, so we sat down and had a conversation about her experiences and what made her go to law school and, you know, her early practice and what she did and what made her want to become a judge. She's so intelligent and she's so well thought out. It was wonderful to talk with her. And before any of the judge stuff happened, I had the wonderful opportunity to work with Rhonda and get to know her a little better. I should say Judge Youngs, and get to know her better through. She was actually researching and writing the history for an article in a legal publication. I think of the Historical Society of the Courts has every county doing there. So I was helping her with that, and we got to know each other. And she was just so amazing and so interested in learning. And as we went on with the conversation, it was at the end of February. As we went on with that conversation, we talked about, you know, what made her prepared and what she had learned in her first few months. And she talked about, you know, they go to a school to learn and then just sitting and listening to people. And we talked about the idea that she was the first woman, and she was more excited by the idea that she was able to help people and that she wanted to represent the people of Madison County to the best of her abilities and be able to make good, sound decisions, which I will never question. It's a great opportunity. We're going to post a little bit of that tonight, the 31st of May. We're going to post just a snippet as well as the actual interview you can see on the county YouTube pages. But it gives you just wonderful insight into who she is and what drives her.
Yeah, and you and I were able to be there when she was sworn in.
Yep.
And, you know, as a woman in the audience, I was, you know, teary-eyed. And it was just her speech was beautiful. Everybody had wonderful things to say about her. The courthouse was like standing room only. It was packed. We had a bird's eye view. It was great. And listening to the interview, you know, nothing's changed for her. She's very humble. You know, for her, it always seemed like it wasn't necessarily always about being a woman, but, you know, she has a passion for justice and the law and the community. You know, she really wants to do something right for the community. And, you know, she even talks about, you know, she's your typical, you know, mom of young kids. She's worried about, you know, okay, I've got this court case, but okay, you're sick. What are we doing for childcare? And I'm like, yeah, that's life. And I think the interview you have with her is really interesting. We'll make sure we put the link in the show notes for this podcast so people can hear from our newly elected judge and what she's been up to. You know, and just she's just another woman that we can mark down here in Madison County history.
She is, and we have many more in our past to talk about, and I have no doubt that we have many women making history as we speak from Madison County, and no doubt that there are more coming that will set the pace in the future. In fact, we have an intern now who her goal is to become a politician someday, so maybe we will be talking about her.
Yeah, I have to get Jenna's autograph before she leaves. And you and I have sat down and talked to several people who are, you know, women in Madison County who have, you know, kind of been trailblazers. So those are always great conversations. And you actually just posted an interview with, it wasn't your interview, but with a woman who was the last female to fly a plane in World War II?
Yeah, so...
She was... Oh, she's awesome.
Yeah.
That interview's great.
we put up a short form, and you can find it. A woman, her name was Mabel, and they called her Barry. Mabel Vincent Smith. And it came up from... I was at the Veterans Dinner in the fall, and a guy walked up to me and said, "Hey, do you know the lady that flew planes?" And I said, "You got to be a little more specific and help me out here." And he said, "I think she was from Chittenango in World War II." And I said, "Okay." So we started to look, and we did find this story of Mabel Barry. And it's insane. She was from Chittenango. She grew up here. Her family moved briefly and came back. She actually graduated from high school in Syracuse. She was living with her cousin. But her brother wrote her a letter and said, "Hey, you know, women are going to be able to fly. You ought to try and fly." And her story is just amazing. She started training in Syracuse, but eventually she lived near Route 5, so she would actually hitchhike 8 miles from Chittenango to the Canastota airfield. Then she would walk the half mile to the airfield. She struck a deal with a gentleman who got a contract to fly planes over GE in Syracuse. So he kept the money from the contract, but she got her flying hours, and she would fly every weekend from Canastota to Syracuse, fly around for 2 or 3 hours, fly back, walk the half mile back to the road, hitchhike back to Chittenango. And she did it until she had her 35 hours of flight time. She enlisted in a program called the WASPs, the Women Air Service Patrol, I believe is what it was called. And ended up serving as a tester, a test pilot. She would fly planes that had come out of maintenance to make sure they were all in good shape. And the WASPs were decommissioned December 20th, and on December 19th, December 20th, 1944, on December 19th, she, in kind of a funny story, was asked to fly someone to Columbus, Ohio. So she did, and she was flying back on December 20th when they informed her that her plane had not done its 100-hour service, and she could not fly. So she called her commanding officer, who said, "You got to stay with the plane." And the plane was finally approved to go back to Waco, Texas, on December 23rd. And by that point, every other woman pilot had been decommissioned. So she was the last woman to fly a plane in World War II. And that was actually the last woman to fly a plane, period, during the war. So she is, if you get a chance to watch her interview, it's about an hour long. We were able to find it. Grand Valley State University in Michigan did it in 2012 or 2013. Unfortunately, Barry passed away in 2014, I believe. But it is a wonderful video and a wonderful opportunity to learn history. And she talks about growing up in Chittenango and flying in Canastota. So you have all these local ties. So thank you to the veteran that came up and asked me, so I was able to find it. And
it's an amazing interview. She became my new favorite person for the day. And I was like, I actually emailed you afterwards. I was just like, thank you for sharing her with me.
Yeah, if you get a chance, she's very funny, and she's very deadpan, and has no problem talking about some of the sexist things she experienced during her time, but she just rolled with the punches and moved forward. And again, an amazing woman with direct ties to our county.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for bringing some of the historical women of Madison County to us today on the last day of Women's History Month, and we will have you back next month. Not sure about what.
Yeah, I haven't gotten that far ahead. We'll figure something out.
What's April again? No, but we always love having you here on the Madison County Milk House. So thank you for joining us.
I always like coming, so keep having me.
We'll talk to you later.
Bye.